dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. We have been focusing intensively for some time now, as has our nation, on Syria as one of the important fronts in the battle space of the war for the free world. Very, very important developments in the space of the past 24 hours with respect to what has likely become of the president's initiative to strike Syria, and to visit about that and kind of the larger argument the president has been making for such an action is our first guest. He is the Honorable, and I mean that quite literally, Douglas J. Feith, former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the George W. Bush administration, currently a senior fellow and director of the Center for National Security Strategies at the Hudson Institute, and the author of the really quite monumental study of an important period in our history entitled War and Decision: Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. Doug Feith, an old friend and colleague, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Glad to be with you.
You and I spent some time a while back thrashing around about a treaty known as the Chemical Weapons Convention. It was, we were told, going to rid the world of chemical weapons. It turns out that some countries, like Syria, did not sign on to the treaty. Others did, but like Syria, I think, have retained chemical weapons stockpiles. And I wanted to just sort of ask you to illuminate for us, if you would, where you think we are now that Russia and Syria have apparently arrived at some sort of agreement and principle about putting the stockpile that, well, Bashar Assad didn't acknowledge he had until yesterday, I guess, under international control. Is that likely to happen? And what challenges are associated with trying to do it?
Well, I think the biggest challenge is the assumption that a criminal regime will behave like a well-intentioned, law-abiding citizen of the world. And I think this is the folly that underlies a lot of the multilateral approach to arms control. It's the assumption that countries that are not law-abiding or law-respecting can join the civilized world in a common effort to do something good. When you do have criminal regimes, and the idea that the criminals sit down with the police and all pretend to be interested in upholding the law is really a folly.
One of the arguments here is that this would bring the Syrian regime into conformity with the international norm, which not only governs, as I say, this idea that we would ban all of these chemical weapons, but we certainly would prohibit their use, something that Syria actually did endorse in the 1925 Geneva Protocol banning the use of chemical weapons. Talk a little bit about this international norm business, Douglas Feith, and the argument that it not only exists, point one, but point two, we have a responsibility to enforce it.
Well, the term international norm is a somewhat vague term, and it's vague because what we refer to as international law is if it's law at all, it's a species of law that is a lot weaker than domestic law. Domestic law is generally backed by the power of a government which can enforce it. International law is not backed in general by an authority that can definitively say what the law is, and it's not backed by a police power that can enforce the law. And so part of the problem with talking about international law is that a lot of people talk about it as if it were like domestic law, you know, clear, ascertainable, and enforceable, when it's not. And then into that debate, people introduce this concept of a norm, which is a way of saying that a lot of, in many cases, well-intentioned people would like to see something be like a law in international affairs, but it's not really a law, so they call it a norm. And it's a very vague concept. And, you know, very often you get a number of law professors basically getting together and agreeing amongst themselves that it'd be nice if the whole world did something the way they believe they should do it. And then they start referring to their own preference as a norm, implying that it's somehow close to being a law that really is obligatory for governments around the world. And the whole thing is very vague and kind of presumptuous.
Well, I get that. Let me ask you to drill down, though, Doug Feith, if you would, on something that, you know, you had to contend with, I think, during your time as the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the George W. Bush administration, namely this notion that the United States military must be put in the service of international law or international norms, even more vague, to enforce where no other mechanism exists to do that. What do you make of that argument? And does it imply both a likelihood we will wind up squandering our military on matters that don't govern or bear directly on our national interests, and that it might impinge upon our sovereignty as well?
Well, I think in general it's more useful to think about a lot of these issues as a matter of national interest rather than as a matter of international law and international legal obligations. Because in many cases, the so-called legal obligations are very vague, and it's not clear that they're obligations at all. And I mean, I've been unhappy that President Obama has talked about the Syria case from the point of view of an American obligation to uphold the 1925 Geneva Protocol on chemical weapons. I agree with people in the administration when they say that we have an interest in shoring up the, and I would refer to it by a non-legal term like taboo, that generally exists as a matter of international politics against the use of chemical weapons. It would be a good thing if nobody used chemical weapons. And there is generally a taboo. And I think it's in the world's interest and it's in America's interest that that taboo be strengthened. And so I think that hitting Syria to impose a severe price on the Assad regime for using chemical weapons is something that would be in our interest if it were done right. The problem that I have is that every time you hear the president and his top advisors talk about it, they suggest that they're thinking about it, I think, in a way that is not clear. And what they're proposing to do about it is not the right way to impose a serious penalty on the Assad regime. And I'm particularly unhappy about the remark that Secretary Kerry made yesterday in trying to persuade Europeans to go along with us. He was saying, what we're going to be doing in Syria is incredibly small or unbelievably small. And he's trying to assure the Europeans, but what it suggests is the action that we would take in Syria would be so small that it wouldn't really influence or severely punish the Assad regime and would allow the Assad regime to say that they stood up to America, survived an attack, and are stronger for it. And so at the end of the day, we might wind up accomplishing the opposite of our intended effect, which would be to strengthen rather than weaken the Assad regime.
This is one of many possible ways in which that outcome may be achieved, I'm afraid, Douglas Feith. And I guess who knows, maybe John Kerry is going to be proven absolutely right. It will be unbelievably small because it won't happen at all as a result of the new gambit between the Russians and the Syrians professing to turn over control of their the Assad regime's chemical weapons. We'll follow this, as I know you will, Doug Feith, closely. I hope you'll come back to us and share your further insights with us in the future. In the meantime, keep up the good work at the Hudson Institute, and thank you for taking the time to join us today. Next up, we'll speak with Michael Auslan of the AEI about both Syria and Asia. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Dr. Michael Auslin. He is a resident scholar and the director of the Japan Studies program at the American Enterprise Institute, a PhD, formerly a professor at Yale University, and a man with considerable expertise on matters involving Asia, including being the subject of a recent book, Pacific Cosmopolitans, A Cultural History of U.S.-Japan Relations. Dr. Auslin, you have recently weighed in on Syria, however, in connection with a letter, an open letter that the Foreign Policy Initiative organized recently. And I'm very pleased to have a chance to talk with you about both Syria and Asia. And welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So we've been talking in the previous segment with Douglas Feith about what this whole business of chemical weapons inspectors and international control might mean for the enterprise that you and Douglas recommended, namely striking Bashar Assad for his use of chemical weapons. Talk to me, if you would, about your sense of where we are at the moment with respect to Syria.
Well, I think the first thing we should do is look at the history of our attempts to have international control over North Korea's nuclear program, or at least an international coalition that would be negotiating and having some resolution to it. Meaning, I think this is probably a godsend for Assad. We absolutely know that over the past several years, the Russians have been entirely unhelpful in anything that has been connected to the interests of the United States. And so therefore, when Moscow suddenly jumps on an offhand remark by Secretary of State Kerry and says, this is a good diplomatic idea, I think we should be wary, number one. Number two, again, if you look at what's been happening with Iran, and certainly you look at the history of North Korea, this could stretch out for months and potentially even longer the ultimate resolution of this issue, whether or not Assad ever gives up his weapons, which we have very little confidence, I think, based on previous historical precedent, or just the rondelay that you would go into negotiations that are broken off and then restarted and broken off, which gives him time ultimately to finish this civil war and win it, and then the whole point of intervening is gone.
So, indeed. We're talking with Dr. Michael Auslin of the American Enterprise Institute, and you have expressed in both your written pieces and just now some misgivings about the competency of the Obama administration. I think you described it as the Keystone Cops at one point. Does the fact that it seems to have gotten into this particular position where the Russians seemingly have capitalized on a statement by John Kerry to throw up new roadblocks further prove your point?
Well, I'm not sure you can find a recent example of greater strategic incoherence than what we're seeing today. And my comment or my written comment on the Keystone Cops was before yesterday's enunciation of the Cheerios doctrine, which, of course, we've all heard.
Talk to us about the Cheerios doctrine. I do want to make sure we cover that.
Well, the Cheerios doctrine is, of course, once again, an unnamed yet ostensibly senior administration official who likened our action to taking away Assad's spoon with which he is eating Cheerios and replacing it with a fork. If this is the point that we've come to, that the government of the United States cannot clearly articulate its rationale, its goals, its processes for how it's going to prosecute a matter of literally life and death, then we have no business being a great power. It's an embarrassment. The use of power in this case, I think, without understanding what we're doing or just to uphold some sort of vague credibility is morally wrong. Red lines are not upheld by a spastic release of powerful weapons. They are upheld by a clear, coherent strategy, and we have none of that right now.
Well, Dr. Auslin, this is pretty much why I found myself on the other side of this divide with many of my friends on this letter that you all signed. I really felt that was evident before and has only been further borne out by recent events. The Cheerio Doctrine, most especially, as you say, the bottom line was, as I recall, the quote that he was going to be able to continue to eat Cheerios. He was just not going to be able to eat them with the efficiency of a spoon. Mind-boggling,
right.
Really. Let me ask you, if I can, because you're a serious student of larger strategic matters, what does this mean for our interests in Asia? You've written that we've pivoted from Asia to Syria. I was never quite clear that we'd actually pivoted to Asia, but talk a little bit about what's happening in Asia from your perspective. You mentioned North Korea, but China obviously looms large as well. And what the interests of the United States as a pretty great power are likely to be as a result of these kinds of developments in another part of the world? Is the effect going to be profound and dangerous, do you think?
Well, I think there's probably at least three levels. The first is a loss of influence and credibility on our part because of this absolutely embarrassing approach, if you can even call it that, that the administration has taken. And everyone looks at what we do, whether we like it or not, and they watch to see how serious we are and how much we have our act together. And in Asia, maybe as much as anywhere in the world. So number one, it's a loss of influence. Second, it's a loss of focus on our part. We have serious challenges in Asia to maintain it as a stable region. And I think that for now, of course, the entire focus of the administration is going to be on the Middle East for probably, again, months. And this administration has not particularly shown that beyond rhetoric, they can really do much in terms of actual policymaking in different areas of the world at the same time. And that's one reason why the pivot itself was problematic. As someone who looks a lot at Asia, I was very happy to see the president acknowledge the importance of the region. But you know, it's a regional power that decides to just look at one area of the world and not another, not a great power. And by even talking about a pivot, and immediately many of our friends in other areas of the world said, that means you're pivoting away from us. And now we see the limits of that. So second, it's a loss of focus on our part. And then third, I would say it's going to be a loss of resources or a drag on resources. I mean, this is an administration that has, I think you can put it gleefully, cut the military, even while asking that military to do more than ever before, as in Libya, and maintaining some level of activity in Afghanistan, which they're trying to, of course, to wrap up by next year. Now you're going to have even more demand on our resources to deal with what's going on in Syria and potential spillover of that. And that's just going to, you know, take more of the pie and suck resources away from Asia. So from that end, too, we're going to be less present and less credible in Asia. And so what it does is it creates a vacuum. It's a vacuum that China has already been trying to fill, that North Korea takes advantage of, and finally, quite frankly, that our friends get very worried about.
Let me talk to you a little bit about those friends in Asia. Again, our guest is Dr. Michael Auslan of the American Enterprise Institute, where he directs its Japan studies. Japan is, of course, very much in the crosshairs, it seems, at the moment of China, not alone in that respect, but particularly so. You've talked about budget cuts to our military. You've talked about distraction being sort of a regional power with one focus now increasingly in the Middle East again. Does that cause a Japan, let's say, to calculate that it's on its own, in your estimation, Michael Auslan? And does that translate in a likely return to militarism on its part, perhaps even to the acquisition of nuclear weapons to protect itself against China, among other things?
Well, I think that Japan, it's not in danger of that today. But Japan, like many of the other Asian countries, thinks very long-term and thinks strategically, unlike us who invest, we think very short-term and not particularly strategically. They have to, and I think often you see smaller powers, and despite its, you know, its great economy size, which is still the world's third largest, it, you know, it is probably classified as a middle power. In the long term, they are worried. They're worried even before this debacle, but they're worried about will the United States ultimately work to blunt or contain, as some would put it, China's influence, and they're agnostic on that question. They see us doing everything we can to reach out to China.
I must say, I'm worried about it too. Michael Auslan, we are out of time, but not out of topics. Let's do this again soon. Thank you very much for your insights on both the Syria and the Japanese-China front. Keep up the good work at the AEI and come back to us very soon. Next up, Seb Gorka talks with us a little bit about the Muslim Brotherhood, where they are in all this mix. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice.
intelligent talk.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday's developments concerning Syria prompt mixed emotions. On the one hand, the Russian gambit to put Bashar Assad's chemical weapons under international control effectively checkmates President Obama's proposal to punish the Syrian dictator for using such arms. Those who saw this as an ill-advised and dangerous idea, including apparently majorities in both Congress and the public, are relieved that it isn't going to happen. On the other hand, neither is Assad's chemical disarmament. As a practical matter, it's impossible to find, let alone neutralize, a large, dispersed, and covert chemical stockpile in a secretive nation amidst a civil war, period. President Obama may try to spin this as a triumph for his threats of military action. Whatever one thought of those threats, though, the outcome is a win for Russia and Assad. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Sebastian Gorka. Dr. Gorka is one of the great thinkers of our time about matters involving the kind of war we find ourselves in. He writes brilliantly on the subject, among other places, for the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, where he is a military affairs fellow. He also teaches in the subject as an adjunct professor at Georgetown University's Public Policy Institute. His latest book, with his wife Catherine Gorka, is Fighting the Ideological War, Winning Strategies from Communism to Islamism. Dr. Gorka, welcome back. It is always good to have you with us. Thanks very much for taking a few minutes.
You're very welcome, Frank. It's always a pleasure.
I wanted to start off, as we have been throughout the program, talking a bit about the astonishing developments of the past 24 hours in Syria. You, as a serious student of the Russians in particular, I think might have some insights into what has happened here in terms of Russian public diplomacy, if you will, strategic plays and information operations. Give us a sense of how they're playing their hand and to what effect.
Well, Frank, they're playing it sublimely well, and I regret to have to make that statement as a person whose father was imprisoned with a life sentence by communists in Hungary after World War II. But in the current Syrian debacle that is going on, there seems to be only one head of state that is acting in a geopolitical sense and is making as much of the current situation to the profit of his own nation, and that is the former KGB colonel Vladimir Putin. It isn't us, and it isn't the French. It's actually the Russian Federation, from releasing this so-called objective 100-page survey on who in fact deployed the chemical weapons, to jumping immediately onto Secretary Kerry's statement that the only possible scenario which would obviate the use of military force by the United States would be if Assad surrendered his chemical weapons. The Kremlin jumped on that and said, oh, really? Well, in that case, let us be the facilitator of that surrender of chemical weapons. So somebody has a plan in the current crisis, and unfortunately, it's not the United States.
Yeah. And what does this do, the way this hand has been played, for the Russians, not simply, but I would like your thoughts on this as well, in Syria, but more broadly, in the region, perhaps vis-a-vis Egypt, which is, it appears, casting about for a new reliable patron, and elsewhere in the world as well?
Well, there's really at least three large aspect to the Russian game as it has currently been played. The first one is, of course, access to the only port in the region that Russia can actually use for its military vessels. The second is, of course, the sale of weapons to Syria as a client state. And the third is an ideological one. Let's look at who Syria's friends are, and that is Russia, that is Iran, that is China. So while these countries all have a different ideological bent to them, some of them being theocratic, the others being communist, and Russia really being a kleptocracy, they're all united by being anti-American. So there's this ideological clique, if you will, that provides one of the reasons for the actions the Kremlin is taking. And as you just mentioned, there is the possibility to play for the breaks, as we say, and exploit the situation to find new friends. Right now, we have the Muslim Brotherhood rejected by the Egyptian people themselves in Cairo, their removal facilitated by the military, a military who thought the United States were their friends, and now feels rejected, hard done by, and is looking for other allies. And this could be the vacuum into which Vladimir Putin steps.
Indeed. You chronicled handsomely the friends of Bashar Assad. You might say a word about his enemies at the moment, and I'm thinking specifically about the Muslim Brotherhood. It seems often to be the case that we overlook the possibility that were President Obama somehow, despite all of the checkmating that I think is going on at the moment with the Russians, he were able to mount a strike, become engaged, as the Foreign Relations Committee resolution says, in changing the momentum of the battlefield, that the Muslim Brotherhood would probably be one of, if not the principal beneficiary of such intervention. Seb Gorka, you spoke brilliantly about the subject at an event the Westminster Institute convened on Capitol Hill last Friday, and I'd invite you to just talk a little bit about the Brotherhood and what it might mean for us, as well as the Syrian people in the region, should they proceed to come to power there if Bashar Assad fell.
Of course. Well, the fact is that the general media and the body politic almost exclusively focuses on Assad as a nasty man, as the following the footsteps of his father, and even a more vicious dictator, and of course the putative use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime. But really, that's not the geostrategic environment. What needs to be understood about the situation in Syria is that it is genetically linked to everything that has been going on in that region of North Africa and the Middle East for the last 2 years, which is quite incorrectly called the Arab Spring. This situation, Syria, is just one consequence of the reignition of Sunni-Shia conflict that is 1,400 years old. Assad is a member of the Alawite clan of Islam, if you will, which is not just a small group, a minority inside Syria, but is deemed by Sunni Islam not to be Islamic and to actually be part of the Shia heresy. As a result, he must be removed by the Sunni extremists, which includes the Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda. And this was the message we had for our event on the Hill on Friday, which is to understand that every single significant leader of Al-Qaeda, be it Bin Laden, Zawahiri himself, Zarqawi, Anwar al-Awlaki, all these individuals started life in the Brotherhood. The Brotherhood is not the same as Al-Qaeda, but it is the gateway to Al-Qaeda, and it is much a threat to the United States, if not more a threat than Al-Qaeda itself is.
Yeah, a tremendously important point, and as I say, unfortunately, all too often, it seems overlooked, even though you have things like Yusuf al-Qaradawi, one of the preeminent Islamist clerics in the world, making clear that he is calling for a fatwa on the Assad regime, and that everybody must become involved in trying to bring down it, and in favor of obviously the Islamists, more of his liking. And let me ask you this: when you look at what the Brotherhood is up to what extent does it appear that the Obama administration's failing to recognize it as a mortal enemy of the United States is contributing to the policies that are perhaps empowering it, certainly have helped bring it to power in Egypt in the past and may in Syria in the future?
Well, it's essential to being able to defeat our enemy. Let's look at the fact not only that these two organizations are genetically linked to each other, but also the fact that the motto of the Muslim Brotherhood has always been that their goal, their strategic objective, is to die in the way of Allah, to actually be shaheed, be martyrs in a holy war against the infidel, which is us. This is not some kind of, you know, innocent political organization that has visions of Jeffersonian democracy bursting out in the Middle East. This is an organization that was created explicitly 4 years after the dissolution of the theocratic empire of Islam, the caliphate, to recreate it, to make sure that there could only be one political, military, and theological system in the world, and that would be the Islamic one. It is, in fact, far longer in gestation, in success, in capacity than is Al-Qaeda, which was only created, as you know, in the 1980s. So this is an organization we must be able to talk about honestly. Our military and our law enforcement must be allowed to examine in its entirety. And right now, unfortunately, that is not the case in this great nation.
Amen. Seb Gorka, we have to leave it at that. I think your admonitions about particularly the sort of civilization jihad character of the Muslim Brotherhood and the danger that it represents to those of us who are not aware that it is even afoot, let alone it is making such great strides, is a very important insight into the mess we're in at the moment. We thank you for your time today and for the great work you do at FDD and elsewhere. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon if you will. Next up, Charles Faddis joins us to give us a sense of the CIA's difficulties in dealing with these sorts of threats and more. Straight ahead.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Charles Faddis. He formerly served with distinction as a CIA operations officer and headed up until about 2008 the agency's Weapons of Mass Destruction Terrorism Unit. He is therefore a man with considerable expertise in a matter that we are very much focused on in the course of this program, in light of what happened yesterday on the Syrian front, namely the idea that we are now
looking at a Russian-Syrian effort to turn over chemical weapons to some international control and thereby spare Syria the retaliation that President Obama has threatened. Charles Faddis, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us. Thank you for your past service and for spending a few minutes with us to talk about the insights you've derived from it about today's events. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you very much.
Let's start with this question. Based on what you know about chemical weapons, is it likely that we would know where all of Bashar Assad's chemical weapons are, let alone have confidence that they've actually been policed up, if it could be done in the middle of a war zone like Syria at the moment?
No, I don't think there's any way on earth that that's possible. I doubt that we knew where they all were with any real certainty 2 years ago. They have undoubtedly been moved multiple times since, and they will be moved multiple times afterward in civilian trucks to unmarked locations. So there's no way on earth that we will know, even if some of them are turned in, there's no way on earth we will know where they all are or whether we ever got all of them.
Well, this suggests that, no surprise to those of us who follow intelligence matters closely, but I think probably something of a surprise to most Americans, that the Central Intelligence Agency, the intelligence community more generally, is not omniscient. It's good, but it doesn't know everything. And talk a little bit about how hard it is to know about things like chemical weapons, their disposition, their condition, and so on.
Well, we collect intelligence, obviously, in a whole bunch of different ways. So, you know, everybody's aware that we collect things by sucking electrons out of the air and by taking pictures from orbit and so forth. But, you know, when you're all done with that, there's a lot of stuff that you're never going to know other than from human sources. And no matter how good you are, that's always going to be incomplete. So there's never such a thing as complete clarity. And quite frankly, we're not even to that end state. I mean, we continue to have, despite the best efforts of some really, really talented people, we continue to have some real problems with the quality of our human intelligence.
In fact, you've written a book on the subject of the condition of the Central Intelligence Agency entitled Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. Is human intelligence a particular problem, or is it really just one manifestation of larger organizational and resource and other problems with the agency?
We have an overall problem, I would submit, in the intelligence community and in our defense establishment with thinking that throwing money at problems automatically solves them. I think it is a particular, it is a particular problem when we get to the area of human intelligence, because it is a very arcane business where what you need are very small numbers of very highly trained, very carefully selected individuals operating in an environment where they can be very creative and move very quickly. This is not the kind of thing where throwing untold amounts of money at a problem fixes it. You know, the more it becomes another bureaucracy, the less capable it is. The bigger and more cumbersome it becomes, the less effective it is.
Indeed. You have talked about starting over with the agency, kind of modeling it in a new incarnation along the lines of the old Office of Strategic Services in World War II. How different would that be, and in what particular respects? And is something like that remotely possible, given today's, you know, investment in the agency and the inertia that always afflicts any kind of serious change like that?
Well, I think it's definitely possible, but it is not possible without strong support from the highest level. So you need the President of the United States to buy into this and put people in position at the CIA who are charged with making this happen. Without that, it's never going to happen. My references to the OSS, really, even though in the book I go to some detail organizationally, the crux of that reference is the culture and the mindset, the focus on the idea that we have a very flat, very flexible structure, and that its entire obsession is with mission accomplishment, not with meetings, bureaucracy, rules, regulations, and procedures, but with whatever it takes to get the job done, that there's no such thing, there's no acceptable answer that says we don't know.
That is something that is very much of, I guess, the character of the present intelligence bureaucracy, that
makes acceptable we don't know. More to the point, may find excuses for not knowing. But again, I'm just mindful that we're where we are. When we were starting the OSS in World War II, obviously lots of things were possible simply because it was a new entity. It was something being stood up in time of war with the exigencies of life and death decisions. You're very much driving calculuses of what can be done and what can't be done. Do you see anything like that, even assuming that there was buy-in at the highest levels possible in today's world and today's circumstances?
I don't see that there is an issue with being able to do it. There is clearly at the present time absolutely no political will in Washington to even attempt it. So there is no such effort underway, and there's certainly no indication that this administration is going to undertake it. On the other hand, if you had a president of the United States come in a few years and put somebody in as the head of the CIA, and that was the charter, would it require breaking some china? It would absolutely require that. Would there be squeals that you could hear for some distance? There would. But it is doable as long as you have the political will and the backing.
We will be very much holding our breath for that kind of presidency and that kind of direction. But before we let you go, Charles Faddis, again, is our guest, a former career Central Intelligence Agency operative and the director of its Weapons of Mass Destruction terrorism program for a period of time. Let me ask you about Benghazi. We're of course, on the eve of the first anniversary of the jihadist attack on our diplomatic mission there and the annex that the CIA ran. Do you have any insights on what was being done there and what should be done to get accountability for what happened on that occasion and the policies that led up to it and the lies that were told afterwards?
Well, first, in regard to Benghazi, I think that anybody who had spent 5 minutes on the ground in Libya or been paying attention at all would have understood that we were putting our people into a place filled with what amount to private, heavily armed armies, these militias. And therefore, putting people in that environment without a very robust, dedicated American security element was an invitation to disaster from the outset, and that did not take special insight. Secondly, I am completely lost as to the administration's response. If you are a member of a terrorist group that strikes Americans all over the world, we find you and kill you, apparently with drones. But if you were involved in the direct attack on our consulate in Benghazi and killing a U.S. ambassador, we have now turned the job of finding you over to the FBI, who is now going to be required to assemble evidence, arrest you, and extradite you to the United States. Why we have two fundamentally different approaches, I have no idea, other than that I think it is a political tactic to effectively prevent us from ever resolving the issue. In other words, we don't really want to have hard answers because they will reflect very badly on this administration.
I'm afraid you're right, Charles Faddis. We will be watching that particular subject closely, as I'm sure will you, and I hope you'll come back to us again. We appreciate your past service to our country and the contribution you're continuing to make. Keep it up, and we will talk with you, I hope, again soon. We'll talk with the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.